Welcome to the second session of the 1981-82 Vancouver Institute season of distinguished lecturers addressing us on a variety of stimulating subjects. The Vancouver Institute is now in its seventh decade. Thus, it is an old and successful organization. We have only one complaint. Our membership is too small. We have no desire to be a small, exclusive elite. In fact, in complete defiance of the contemporary fashion that small is beautiful, we continue to believe that bigger is better. Thus, we welcome your membership. The fee is small, even insignificant. $2 for a student, $10 for an ordinary single member, and $15 for a family membership. Memberships will be available to you on your way out of the hall at the end of the lecture. Do join. We need you, and we would like to have your money. If you cannot hear the speaker from the back of the hall, do not hesitate to either raise your hand, in which case I will attract the speaker's attention and induce him to speak more loudly, or since the lights will be dimmed because we are having slides, don't hesitate to say politely, but in a voice that can be heard, louder, please. We would rather have that than you going away disgruntled, not having heard. So our speaker this evening, Dr. Alexander Minkowski of the Port Royal Hospital in Paris, has acquired such an impressive list of achievements, positions, and awards that I can do no more in my introduction than skate superficially over the surface of his career. He is director of the Center for Biological Research on Fetal and Neonatal Development in Paris. He has been a visiting professor at numerous universities, including Yale, Harvard, and Stanford. He has many, I might even say innumerable, publications to his credit, including, to a social scientist, the startling figure of 200 publications dealing with fetal biology alone. Dr. Minkowski, however, as his CV indicates, is more than a scholar. He has had a distinguished military career in World War II with the Finnish, Norwegian, and Free French forces. He has been the recipient of many military awards and government medals. Most recently, just several months ago, he was made an officer of the Legion of Honor in France. This evening, he will speak to us on the topic, as listed in the program, Practical Medicine and the Developing World. However, in a slight huddle he had with me before we began, he said, "What is practical medicine? Where did the title came from?" I indicated that absolutely no one was responsible for this, and he suggested, therefore, that I draw to your attention what he feels would be a more correct description of his talk, Field Medicine and the Developing World, with special reference to the care of children. Dr. Alexandra Minkowski.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great privilege and great honor to be the guest of the very well-known Vancouver Institute, and I hope to feel my duty to inform you more or less accurately in this year of the handicap of what the situation is for care of the children in the developing world. When I say children, this includes, of course, the mothers and, in general, all the population. Now, I hope that my English will be understandable. I worry a little since I have given some interviews within the last 4 days, and in one of the papers I was told to have a heavy French accent, so I hope to try to have a Canadian accent, if I may. Now, my work is generally busy. I am busy in my work with something which has nothing to do with the subject I am going to talk about this evening. I was trained as a Rockefeller Fellow in Harvard Medical School, and I learned all I know in the States from very prominent neonatologists, pediatricians, like, among other, Sam Levine and Clement Smith and others. And up to that time, around 65, I thought that in doing my work in a laboratory, in research, in science, and also in care, this would probably be the best way to fulfill the duty of a pediatrician against this plague, which was and which still is the prematurity of birth, because it exposed not only to death, but even more to handicap. And something happened which gives me another insight, which I have not been thinking of up to that time. In 65, I was the French government, who was very scarce about information in Popular Republic in China. In fact, the diplomats couldn't get around Peking more than 10 miles, thought that a doctor could be more free, and they asked me to go to China just at that time, which of course I accepted, not as a spy, but just to give them some information. And I went there, and if you'd be interested in that, I went there for the first time in 65 with two very well-known Canadian pediatricians. We were not on the same team, but we met constantly. And it was Dr. Alan Ross from Montreal and Dr. Scriver, also from Montreal. And I was so enthusiastic about what I saw in the field of prevention medicine, preventive medicine, which nobody has taught me, nor in the States, neither in France, that they said I have been indoctrinated. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't enlist in the Communist Party, but it is true that this insight in the way the Chinese, about 900 million people at that time, were dealing with the human people in terms of medicine, let me think that, it's not to say that I was wrong, but I was doing the thing in the reverse way. In other words, I would take care in an intensive care unit of very small infants, but I didn't care very much why they have been there and what could be done to prevent that. In fact, we can treat the very young infants, but there is not much we can do. We can make them survive. We can even try to improve their brain situation, but in sometimes we cannot prevent handicaps. And so the best way to prevent handicaps is to give prenatal care and to do preventive medicine, which nobody has taught me. And certainly you know that in the United States, where there is no public health system as the one which prevails in your country, the preventive medicine didn't exist. And everybody was very, I would even say, snobbish about making very sophisticated medicine and forgetting about the rest. And maybe this explained to you the title of this speech, this talk, which is Field Medicine. En français, on dirait la médecine de terrain, maybe ground medicine, as opposed, there is not such a thing as practical and theoretical medicine, because really medicine has always to be practical when you have to practice it, as it is said. But there is, of course, an opposition between what we have like here or in my place in Paris, l'université. I am professor of neonatology at Université René Descartes, and the thing we do is only advanced sophisticated medicine, especially in our field, because we just have 4 days of perinatal teaching and symposia here, in which we know now that a baby born at 26 weeks, which means 5 months and a half, which weighs 700 grams or 750 grams, has a chance to survive of about 75%, with a minimal chance to have serious cerebral sequelae of the order of 5 to 8%, which I think is quite an advance due to research. So the Chinese, I think, changed completely my mind, and this was in 65. I got back twice in China. I went twice in the Vietnam and once during the war. I went 3 times in Cambodia, in Laos, in Thailand, and it means that more or less I specialized in this area of the world, Southeast Asia. Next to that, in January, I will go to Bangladesh. And it offers me the occasion to change, to have another view of medicine, and to discover that when I say we did the reverse, it means that it is all right to do sophisticated medicine, provided that the general medicine is done properly. And there is a sum of underestimation of that way of medicine, at least in France, maybe elsewhere. In order to be respectful and interested in specialties, and to forget that the general practitioner, when he has a good background, is probably the key to public health. Some people have understood that, like the Dutch, for instance, and of course, I won't say that in China they have enough doctors to do that, but they do it through some auxiliary of medicine, like the barefoot doctors, like the midwives, like the nurses, and after all, those people with a minimal, like what they call the accelerated doctor, who does only 3 years of medical studies, and there it's true, he doesn't get basic science teaching, just he knows how to practice medicine. Maybe then practical medicine is justified. So I will not give a sort of academic talk with diagrams, with such things, because I think I would prefer to live with you under my different experience in those countries. And I will start with Cambodia, and at the occasion of the slides, I will comment them, and I think you yourself would try, and I hope to do it also, a sort of synthesis of the subject. Now, Cambodia has been in Cambodia just about a year and a half from now, just at the time that they were threatened with starvation. And there have been all sorts of wrong news about Cambodia. I can tell you I am not a communist, but I have been a little surprised by the comments that you would read either in the French press or even in the American one in Paris, Herald Tribune, saying that in Cambodia there were no more children, that nobody could be pregnant, and that it was devastating things. And they accuse the Vietnamese, the invaders, the recent invaders, to perform a sort of genocide in Vietnam, in Cambodia. Now, when I went there, and I didn't want to go with some people from the Communist Party in France who were the first to discover that the situation was not so bad as we read it in the press, and I think they gave us a great service in doing that. But I didn't want to go with them because when you go with somebody from the French Communist Party, they always make with you a sort of political operation, and I wanted to be independent. So in order to be independent, I was enlisted by the Catholic Committee for against hunger and for development, and I think being a Jewish, I was at my right place. In the first slide, you'll see one of the first thing I discovered was that despite 3 million people killed by the Khmer Rouge regime, I would like to remind you that the Khmer Rouge regime is officially recognized by the government of the United States and by the government of China, just in passing. So, first of all, I discovered that in Cambodia, there were an enormous amount of children, I can number them, not only above 5 years, but also below, and that there were numerous maternity, and here you can see a Cambodian mother, among many others. And the only already I noticed that despite the fact that they have no equipment, they were very clean in the birth. There were not such a complication as umbilical tetanus, which prevails mainly in Africa and in all places where there's no hygiene, because the Cambodians have been trained to be clean. And again, to be clean in Asian countries in the third world is already a proof of feeling of public hygiene. So in each maternity hospital, there were about 200 or 300 pregnancy per month, which were accompanied by most normal birth, not many premature, and not infectious complications. I have to tell you that I made a 1,000 kilometers tour in about all the area of Cambodia. Now, just to tell you how absolutely deprived of equipment, I will tell you the story of those two children you see here. They are 2 years of age. This is Battambang. Battambang is near the border of the Thailand. It's a big town of 250,000 inhabitants. The main hospital is completely deprived of electricity. They have to boil the sterile water to make operations. There is no surgeon. Out of the 500 doctors in Cambodia, because of the massacre by the Khmer Rouge, 50 only were left, and they were with the international help, as you know, UNICEF, International Red Cross, people from the communist country, Oxfam, le Comité catholique contre la faim, le Groupement communiste des Français, etc. So, despite they would give some help at Phnom Penh, that was very far from Phnom Penh, and when we got there, as I say, there was no electricity in the hospital, there was no surgeon, so the operation was made by a sort of auxiliary person, agent, who has watched the surgeon when he was with the French, and who, by this way, learned to make operations, and he was helped by the chief doctor of the place. Now, that might sound very dangerous. Well, we saw that because they operate very clean, those two children were wounded by mines, as it happens every day to hundreds of children in Cambodia. So they have open wound in the abdomen. They were sutured, they were cured, their intestine was repaired, and you can see them 1 month after the operation, no pus, nothing, just good care. And I don't say that this is the way we should perform operation, but at least we can know that without sophisticated equipment, those people were able to do magnificent operations, and I have seen that a number of times. Now, here you'll see two young persons who have been wounded by the Khmer Rouge just near the Thailand border, and they brought their child. You can see that they know beds. It's very primitive, still in Battambang. And my general impression was that here is one of the rare cases of malnutrition. You can recognize edema, pallor. But at the time we came, I think the effort made by the whole world, and I think it's interesting to bring it over. Everybody was speaking of Cambodia, so the effort made by the international world was so well done that hunger didn't prevail. But I come to the main thing in a few minutes in talking to you about the disease and how the people of the children of the third world have no access to care. I am not talking specially about Cambodia, but in general. Here you can see another child in the hospital, just to show you the very equipment, the very primitive equipment. Here, because this is the year of the handicap, you can see near the temple of Angkor a child who has been amputated, and I show you the two infants. Now, children are being amputated very frequently just because the country is still full of mines and shells. Now, this is in Phnom Penh. I show you, I don't know if it can be focused a little. It shows you mothers waiting to the distribution of milk, and they have in their hands, in their arms, their infants with whom they would nurse. And of course, in those countries, most of the mother supply breastfeeding, and it might last 1 or even 2 years. And in general, you can see that those people are not really in poor shape, and you'll go on in seeing that. This is also a picture which represents the enlistment of the communist new Cambodia regime. This is an institution for orphans. There are about 200,000 orphans in Cambodia. There are a lot of widows because, as I told you, each family has lost a few members during the Khmer Rouge regime, and they are already, you know, acting like what I have seen in Vietnam, a sort of military embrigading, if I should say so. And of course, the fate of Cambodia, if it remains that way, is a little subject of pain, because I knew Cambodia before this regime. It was one of the most free country in Southeast Asia. Next, we'll show you again a family in the country with all the children, again, who doesn't seem to be in bad shape. Here, it's just also to tell you, this is a picture I took more or less in 65, when there was a Sihanouk regime. This is an ethnic called the Cham, who includes at that time 150,000 people, and they were completely killed, all of them, by the Khmer Rouge regime. So it's almost a historical view, because I saw them in 65. Then none of those individuals are left. Now, this is show you how they supply food. They would make 200 or 300 kilometers with the bicycle to Thailand to bring the food. So on the roads, that's what you would see. Again, some children and some family. And here again, the sort of military atmosphere prevailing in an elementary school with the salute, the Cambodian salute. A panel showing the tortures of the Khmer Rouge and here something which was of interest for us French. It is the only country at the moment where French is still the official language. Of course, I don't think it will last. And those are nurses who were taught anatomy in French, and I was fortunate enough to give some lessons of not anatomy, because I don't know it anymore, but on pediatrics. And this is again another group of orphans, again to show you how many children there are. Now you might be interested, this was a hospital which was transformed by Pol Pot, the chief of the Khmer Rouge, in a crocodile station in order to make money from the crocodile skin. And so this is a remnant of what Pol Pot did. I visited the Temple of Angkor with an escort of a Vietnamese soldier having his pistol in my back. but I survived. And here is the main artery, the Mekong, on which one part of the supply arrives. And then, in order to end up, I would like to show you how looked Cambodia before that time. It was an ideal country with no problems, with sense of freedom, and through all the politics, and I don't want to talk too much about it, it has been ruined. So you'd see the paradisic atmosphere, like in the Gauguin pictures, the rice, and see that is near Siem Reap, and really, it resembles very much the Gauguin pictures. And I think we come to the last one. The bonzes at the airport, that was also in 65. This is just to show, finally, that la mode is still prevailing despite the difficulty of the situation. And this is just now. In front of the Temple of Angkor, you can see that the Cambodian ladies and girls try to be still very elegant. Now, this is just a sort of journalistic aperçu, and I would like to comment now about the situation in Cambodia. I think there is one more. No, that's Vietnam. Yes, in order to say what are the problems in Cambodia, the whole world make a magnificent effort, and especially the UNICEF. You know that there was a Vancouver Day of the UNICEF 2 days ago. And those provide ways to improve the food supply. But unfortunately, and this is an example of what prevails in the third world situation, the 80% of the children and the adults are infested with either malaria, ankylostomosis, ascaridiosis. They are exposed to a very severe anemia. And in many instances, they will die not from hunger, but from parasitosis or for infection. And I would like to illustrate this because this is the typical example of the thing we have to do in the third world. The third world lacks completely access to care. And one has to really know that. And the reason is that except for China and Vietnam, and maybe now Cambodia, but there's a long way before achieving this, because of the complete absence of the so-called elementary medicine, all the people try to imitate the Western world. And the Western world in general agrees with that, supply with heavy equipment that they don't need or they don't know how to use. And this is completely absurd, because I could tell you, according to some statistics, that 70% of the population of the developing world has absolutely no access to care, because everything is concentrated in urban cities and nothing in urban area. And in some country, the number of doctors is 1 per 17,000. So it might say that the target that we have in mind consists on trying to help, and I will discuss that at the end, about 200 million people who are in danger because of parasitosis and infection mainly. And I have attended that in Cambodia. Just to see something else, and we go now to the country like Vietnam and China, and believe me, this doesn't prove that I have been indoctrinated, like Alan Ross and Scriver said, but those countries have made a big effort to develop public health situation. And I just would illustrate what I saw first. I have been 3 times in Vietnam, and the first time during the war. Now, some of you have read in some papers to which I gave interview here, that I advocated strongly midwives to take care of the mother and the child. And I can tell you that even in the middle of the war in 68, under bombing, the midwives would accomplish their work with great skill and care in difficult conditions, because everything has been destroyed in Vietnam but Hanoi. And they, for instance, have wells with clean water. Here is a swamp in which it's forbidden for the children to swim, contrary to Cambodia, in order to avoid. And they are taught that way at school. In order, an interesting feature is that public health doesn't belong to doctors. Sometimes I say public health is too serious a problem to be given only to the doctors. And so public health is a population problem, and I try with my friends in Canada to and in my country to try to have the population taking part. So in the same time, no child will swim there, and no child will drink but boiled water. And this means a lot of precaution in all respects. Through that, in North Vietnam at that time, there was no cases of malaria. Parasitosis were partially eradicated. And I think it was really an effort during the war, which was absolutely stupendous. Now, this is just a shelter, an air shelter, yes, not a shelter, it's a place where they would design a plane when there was an alarm raid. And here you see the very primitive way. This is a very interesting also. The American army have a lot of trouble because they also have a very little mobile system of care. All the wounded people have to be transported first to a place where they could have good care. The Vietnamese inaugurate a system which is exactly the reverse. They would go to the disease, they would go to the wounded with mobile units that they could move. And really, it's true that at the moment they are incapable to repair the economy and the country, but as for to have to be astute enough to and have the skill to do things, you can see that in this mobile unit, a nurse would pedal to feed the electrogenic battery, and all the system is that, maybe I don't say it properly, so that pedalage, she makes the electrogenic group to function. Now here, this is another thing for a pediatrician, you should see the children of a very young age and without their teacher going into the shelters during the bombing, and all those very young children at the nursery school would know how to make a first aid bandage and to put a clamp, garrot, how do you say garrot? Tourniquet. And no trouble, they would go and sew. And you see a thing what struck me very much in China and Vietnam is the way the very young children become independent very early. Now, of course, it changed at the adulthood. This is their famous straw hat to protect them from the fragmentation bombs. This is a laboratory technician in Vietnam who does prepare anti-measles virus vaccine. And again, in the mobile unit, midwife, all the care was made by the midwife who take care of gynecologic problems of the premature babies, etc. And they were well trained. Again, this picture shows it. A laboratory technician also in this mobile unit in which I have seen a very young child operated. This is a young fisherman who has been wounded by arrow bombing. You can see the arrow along the spine. And here a picture of the herbicide destruction. And here the traditional medicine, which also exists together with the other one. In China and Vietnam, the traditional medicine, the medicine with herbs, is a part of the culture. So neither the Chinese nor the Vietnamese thought they should suppress it. And contrary to what you see in Vietnam, those are Vietnamese in Cambodia who live near this dirty water in which they make their, they go to the toilet, they drink the same water, they bathe in it, and so, of course, they are infested with parasites. At that time, Cambodia was under the control of the WHO, and it was completely inefficient. So just to show you the same population in two systems of public health. Now, when I come next to China, you will see that the same is prevailing. So what are the conclusions that we can take for that system? Well, they asked me in Vietnam to create intensive care unit and so forth, and it was a little difficult to make that under such difficult conditions, especially during war. But at least I saw that they were able to have a very good healthy system, and I thought that either the Vietnamese or the Chinese, especially the Chinese who are now in the WHO system, could introduce such a good preventive medicine everywhere. Another reason, I explain it to you, in a village, it is the chief of the village who detains the statistics of immunizations. He knows how is the population. In fact, there is no doctors, and after all, there are some public officers, there is the chief, the mayor, and everybody knows about public health, so it comes as an education thing at school. And in doing that in a widespread manner, which I wish we could have in the same way, they succeed in preventing not all diseases, but most of them. And in China, it's the same. Here is a maternity, and you can see it's very primitive. It's held by a midwife, and all over China, this is it. They take weekly blood pressure in order to prevent toxemia, and of course, toxemia, by that frequent preventive, very simple measure, has almost been eradicated for China. At least they claim it. Now, just to tell you how primitive is the system, you can see here an ambulance, and it is not the car. The car is only the police car, because in China there are almost no cars, and the ambulance is just a bicycle and who has a little cart behind. And I was told that in case the person who is transported has to have oxygen treatment, the nurse will pedal at his side, bicycling on one side and holding the mask at oxygen on the other side. And of course, it's an occasion to smile because it's very primitive. All the Chinese system, who doesn't hold any good modern equipment or almost none, goes in that way. And the barefoot doctor has a training of 6 months. He's taken about a skilled person in the commune or in a factory, and he knows how to do all the elementary gestures. And besides, as I told you, there is a system of having accelerated doctors who know only practical medicine and who might help in such a developing country. So if you complement that by the fact that in a factory or in a rural commune, a midwife would take care of a pregnant woman in a very elaborate way. She would see her every day, she see if she's fatigued, change her job if this is too painful. She would have facilities to rest. And when the mother have to go at work and give breastfeeding, there are nurseries, so they go at their work with their babies, and they have a very good nursery. And they come to give breastfeeding every 3 hours. And I think this is the only country who has performed such an accomplishment, because it's very difficult to do that in our country, at least in France, and I guess in Canada as well. Now, just to show you the independence of children, those children, the parents are at work, and for the day being, they are under the direction of one young girl with a red flag, and this young girl, at the age of 8 to 10, knows everything about vaccination, vitamin supplementation, etc. And of course, this is through that system, the general condition of health seems to be good. This is just to show you another aspect of the children at that time. The young children, at that time, there was no question of peace between Americans. It was the opposite. and those children are supposed to drive their guns against the American imperialism. That's the view of the Yangtze. Now, I'd like to tell you also, at that time, this might have been changed, they wanted to mix up all the classes. So in this combinat, who has 10 million people at work, I have seen a bunch of 50 medical students who would come to work as the workers every summer. And also, the dean of the Chinese Peking Medical School would go in rural area to recite all an area. This is a so-called democratic system in China, which I don't know if it's good or not, but I think it was a good thing that sophisticated doctors has to do some very elementary duty. And I am sure that we pediatricians, we don't mind in just doing things which seem very simple, because in the care of children and mothers, many things have to be done which do not need an enormous amount of background. Now, this is also the combinat. Focus slide. Just at that time, you can see on a pagoda a man pointing against the American imperialist, but that was in 65. Things have changed. The Yangtze River with the bridge where Mao used to swim, and it's a site of pilgrimage where now the students came, not anymore now, of course. And this is a very capital point in China, so the CIA knew that there was some exercise of students, and they saw it was an exercise of frogmen to invade Taiwan. Again, the Yangtze. All right, so this illustrates, I think, an organization, of course, during that time of so-called democratization. I think the inconvenience is that the Chinese lost the pace with modern medicine, and they want now to be able to do it, and they will, but they have a basic system. I can really tell you that they impress me so much by the way they have people going at home, doing homework, home visits for pregnant women, doing immunization at home if somebody would have forgotten, that it is a mass prevention, which means that everybody has access to care. It's surprising in a way that in a communist country where freedom doesn't exist, that in the same time the public health system holds such a respect to the human individual health. That I must admit, despite any political opinion. Now, finally, again, I would show you another example. I have been also to Cuba, and I can comment on Cuba if this comes up into the discussion. And I have been also in other countries, Latin America, etc. I won't talk about everything, but I want to illustrate another side of the way people do their medicine and preventive medicine, or do not their preventive medicine, even when they have money. I have visited the Palestinian camps. I was invited by the Palestinian Red Crescent, and here you can see some of the children with the military dress, because from the very early age they have military exercise. As I'm talking freely with old people, I objected that very much, because I thought that this would endanger the whole Middle East someday. Now, this is an aperçu of Tal el Zatar in the middle of Beirut, which was completely destroyed. This is also another aspect of Tal el Zatar. This is Palestinian children at the Israeli border in a so-called Palestinian camp. I would like to describe those Palestinian camps. There are 400,000 people who are living
with an evacuation of the garbage in plein air, because the Lebanese forbid to build up closed tubes to evacuate the dirty water. And they live in very poor hygiene conditions, and they have rather a poor preventive system. You know, they get a lot of money from Saudi Arabians, and they spend all their money in building underground hospital for open-heart surgery. They want to perform something extraordinary. At the same time, they have no idea, like most of the Arabian countries, Egypt, in which I have been, Egypt, Northern Africa, Maghreb, etc. And they all seem, when you want to tell them that they should imitate the Chinese or the Vietnamese system with very simple field medicine, they would say that we treat them as underdeveloped people and as ex-colonial people. And that's a main trouble in order to... I was there for a few weeks, and I couldn't succeed in persuading them to try to change the system because, for instance, the perinatal care is given not by midwives but by matrons, old-type matrons who have no idea of obstetrics, and of course the perinatal death and handicaps is very high. So there, I think, there is really very little hope, like it is, for instance, in Central Africa. I could tell you that in Mali, there are 300,000 births per year, and out of those 300,000 per year, 8,000 women die in the course of the delivery, which is a thing which one doesn't see anymore, and about twice as much have genital wounds because nobody knows how to cure the torn or every wound who intervenes during the delivery times or any time. So this is a terrible situation, and of course the percentage of death in children amounts something like 500 sometimes per 10,000. So per 1,000, sorry. So I think one out of two. And in country like Mali, there again no access to medical care. Here in the Palestinian camps, maybe there are some dispensary. And I would like to finish with two pictures of Beersheba in the Negev desert in Israel, because I'd like to tell you something which medicine only permits and which I think is a nice link between so-called enemies. This is a Moroccan Jew in Beersheba. This is another one. And now I think the end of my pictures, and I would like to have the light. Where is it, please? Now, I think sometimes one has to be enthusiastic about the link that medicine allows. I hope you don't mind me being a little sentimental in that, because I was very much impressed by a colleague of mine in the desert of Negev. It's very well obvious that the situation between the Arabs and the Jews in Israel is very difficult, and the people in Israel contempt the Arab people. So, and I'm sorry to say that, I'm sorry if I hurt people in the audience, but really this is not conformed to what I have been taught by my parents as far as international Jewry is concerned. And it's very hard to see. I have been during the German occupation to see everything in that respect, even if it's due to war and to the danger that prevails in Israel. That I must recognize. However, in the Negev, a young pediatrician by the name of Karplus and his wife, and this is the year of handicap, and I'm happy to report on that, his wife is specialized in rehabilitation of handicapped children, and they both have learned Arabic language. And in the Negev desert, there is about 50,000 Bedouins. And they have completely, by their own initiative, made a sort of field medicine, which I have attended, which consists in having some mobile post or ambulances in the middle of the desert, and you would see in the middle of the desert a small car or a small hut, and from distance, which would amount 5 to 10 miles, you would see the mother with the Palestinian, the Bedouin mother with the black dresses, coming with her child and children in the arm and be taken care properly, as well as the handicapped, by this extraordinary couple. To me, this extraordinary Israeli couple does far more for a peace in the Middle East than all the politicians. As you might find me very naive, but really, in those areas, such gestures are of paramount importance. Now, I would like to come to an end to answer you as many questions as I can answer. Of course, I don't pretend to be a specialist of the Third World, but for some reason, I am very much convinced that the duty of the Western world is not to make charity to the Third World, to supply heavy equipment, and to think that this is the way to help them. In the contrary, I think it's a sort of arrest in the way they need the care. And it's very difficult for many reasons. First of all, most of the Westerners have toward the underdeveloped world a so-called paternalistic attitude. When I was in Phnom Penh, I was very much struck by an Italian by the name of Onesta Carpenet, who distinguished herself very much from the other organization, because she was able, even with the lack of knowledge that the Cambodian had at that time, to speak to them in an equal tone, and not to say, you don't know anything, I'm going to tell you. And I think this is fundamental. So in the same time, I don't think it's good to go in those countries and to tell them what they ought to do. The primary attempt is to persuade them to set up small auxiliary posts for care in as many places in rural area which is necessary. And in fact, we can apply that even in our countries. As you know, even in Canada, which is has some desertic areas, even in France, when there are areas which are completely isolated in the time of winter, there sometimes is no medical good care. And of course, if we have that in mind, we would not be obscured by the necessity to have very heavy, very expensive equipment when the field medicine and preventive medicine is not accomplished. Now, when I say one has not to do a charity, I think I have learned a lot on the Third World. I think that I am sure that in a country like yours, who has been having a very good attitude during the Vietnamese War, for instance, and in other circumstances, one cannot just think of its own country in thinking that there are so many people in danger in their health, in their life, in their brain. And I think it is not only a duty, I think it's our own interest. By all means, the exchange between the Third World, in which we have sometimes something to learn, is that because they supply many raw materials to the East at very low expenses, at low price, as you know, sometimes they would realize it, and I think at that time there would be an explosion in the world. So it is not an affair of power, it is just an affair of feeling of exchange between people who are not having, for many reasons, the same degree of culture and development, in taking on account, by the way, their own culture again. A good example of that is even made when we look at our underdeveloped population in our own countries. You probably know the expression fourth world. What is the fourth world? The fourth world, the children of the fourth world are living in cities like Detroit, like New York, like the suburbs of Paris, and in fact, they hardly they almost compare in the poverty and lack of care with the third world. So even in our own country, we have to face this problem, and I don't think we give enough of thinking in that respect. And again, if you ask me, do you do that because you have a feeling or by charity, I don't think so. I think it's interesting. And instead of thinking this elementary field medicine is just the second-rate exercise of our art, I think it's about as interesting or even more than to do laboratory research and others. And in fact, if we do pay attention to this side of medicine, I think we will be more faithful to our profession. Thank you.
Dr. Minkowski will be pleased to answer questions. If you would raise your hand, make your question as clear as possible. I'll ask the speaker to repeat the question so that the audience can hear, and I'll recognize you by pointing.
Dr. Minkowski, since you talk about very high infant mortality and maternal mortality, how do you account for the fact that many of these emerging countries double their populations in from 20 years to 25 years? I find it difficult to reconcile.
You find it difficult to?
To understand, with this high infant mortality, how are they doubling their population every 20 years, every 22 years?
Well, the country in which this mortality prevails are not probably the one who dubbed their population. The country I was mentioning are mainly some country in Central Africa where the rate of birth is not so high, as you mentioned. The place where the rate of birth is very high are mainly Asian countries and Latin America, where the mortality rate is not as high. Now, I think your question brings up the problem of, it is true, we have specialists in food problem, agricultural problems, who would tell you that someday, even if the whole land of the world, of the earth, is cultivated, there won't be enough food for such people. So contraception is absolutely necessary. I think you don't mind if I see that side of your question. Interestingly enough, I didn't mention that for the Chinese, but you know that even in our country, and I am talking about pregnancy in young girls now, which is becoming an acute problem for everybody, including pediatricians and obstetricians and the families, not enough effort is made to teach contraception properly. It's in the hands still of the family and the doctors. Now, in China, you might be interested, because, of course, it's not a very simple procedure, to put a, comment est-ce qu'on dit, stérilet? Stérilet, same word? Yeah. Not sterilization. Okay. Thank you. And to take the pill is not a very simple procedure. Now, in China, it's interesting that this procedure of contraception is not, well, you might be surprised, except for the when a sterile has to be put, but the absorption of pill, the way it should be taken, is taught entirely, it's entirely in the hands of the women association, the unions, etc., and it's a routine procedure. So even in the rural area, very remote area, this exists, and I think there's no problem. I am very much inclined to think that we have to find a system through which information should be provided to everybody. Now, another thing that your question raised, very important, and I am thinking about the Moroccans and the Algerians, is that no effort is made against the doubling of the population by people like the Moroccans and the Algerians because they want to have as many people as possible to fight each other. And Tunisians, Tunisia, which is a very small country, instead has a policy of contraception and to try to not to encourage more than 2 children. And as you know, in China now, because they have housing problems, they insist on having a system to try to have the people having only 1 child. And I saw a Chinese doctor in Toronto just a few days ago who tried to confirm that this was so, and I think they achieve it. So when you mention how this is possible, when we speak of that, we speak of the whole population. And as you know, in Latin America, through maybe the influence of the Catholic Church, and I'm sorry to say that in front, I represent the Catholic Committee, so I am not prejudiced. But when the Pope comes to Mexico and says something against contraception, I think everybody of you who has been in Mexico can see this is wrong, because you know that Mexico is a site of an enormous amount of misery, because many men have 3 or 4 families in which there are as many children as possible, and I'm sure you have, those of you who have been in Mexico have seen beggars with small children in their arms. So the whole problem at the moment lies first of all in the generalization of contraception and also maybe in the simplification of it. Of course, when prostaglandins will be available, this will be more simple, and I think this is the only hope. But I am not a demograph, and maybe what I tell you is not absolutely satisfactory. I'm sorry. Yes?
You talk about the high mortality rate amongst the mothers in some of the
Mali, yes. No. No, well, of course, you talk about another problem in which we are interested in France and probably in your country. Infibulation and all the torture that are inflicted to a number of young girls in Africa, including Egypt, surprising but true, including southern Algeria, but mainly in African countries. You know that it's a real torture, but for a long time, the UNESCO people said that we shouldn't interfere with the local cultures. And in fact, this is not a completely wrong argument. Now, no, I don't think this has anything to do with this, because at the time, women have children, well, they are liberated in some way. But no, the perinatal, the woman mortality is very high just because of absence of cleanliness and very bad knowledge of elementary obstetrics. So again, when you see that 2 countries, China with 1 million inhabitants and Vietnam, who was able to have a very good public health system in the middle of a terrible war, were able to do a very good public health system, including contraception, and getting rid of all the parasitosis infest the world. I think you just are on the spot, because this has been possible in 2 countries like this. I think it should be extended. I tell you another detail, just to show you the reaction. Last year I was in Egypt to launch a program of French-Egyptian cooperation for children, and I picked up a subject, malnutrition in the Delta, because I have been visiting the Delta, and at the same time, I would have seen, Americans supply a lot of equipment in Egypt, incubators, computers, TV machine, so you would come, it's really a gag. You come into an intensive care nursery, you'd see all sorts of modern equipment that maybe neither Dr. Siegel or myself possess, and nobody knows how to use it. And at the same time, they pretend to have an intensive care unit, and the intensive care unit is almost empty because they are in fear to just put a child in an incubator. This is in Cairo. So I was impressed by the fact that field medicine does not exist in Egypt, and I try, because of my little knowledge, to launch this kind of medicine. And for political reasons, the agreement was made between the Chinese, the Egyptians, and the French government, and for some reason, I was told that this was a sort of lack of prestige medicine. See, again, we are back to this, to that disease. Yes?
Can you comment on the rather aggressive selling of tin formula by such firms as Nestle to the third world?
Yes. But this is a rather long story. How much time do I have? No, because I have been involved in that personally. So the story of Nestlé is...
repeat the question.
Oh, I think if I understood you properly, can you comment on the Nestlé with the baby killer affair? All right. This is a very good question, but of course it cannot be solved in 1 second. And I have been involved personally in the problem. Now, we learned with a bunch of Americans, among them people from Harvard, people from Uruguay, about 12 years ago. We were in Mexico for a symposium, and we happened to learn that some fancy-dressed nurses, who were not nurses at all, would go in the country villages, the Indian villages, which are very poor, as you know. The luxury in Mexico is just a privilege of certain class, and most of the country is miserable, despite everything. So we learned that, and we were extraordinarily surprised, and I think we launched, with the help of the Mexican TV, a sort of campaign which lasted an hour against that process. Was somebody from Harvard, Dr. Clement Smith, Dr. Caldero Barcia from Montevideo, two Mexican people, and myself. And we got a silver medal by the Mexican TV for having done that. We're very proud of it. But next to that, the Dr. Jellyfay, you know, the man from San Francisco, launched the whole campaign against the baby killer, and I think he was right. At the same time, Nestlé Company had a new milk for premature called Alprem. When we analyzed this Alprem, we found out that it was completely improper for premature children. So I wrote an article in Le Monde, the well-known journal in Paris, and we call it Les Multinationales, with all the aggressive way of mercantile business they do. So the Nestlé company in Switzerland reacted in asking one of their doctors to counteract what I have said, but it's impossible because it is true. So in general, they found out that probably this doesn't come from the direction in Switzerland. some people somewhere have launched that, and it was widespread. I'm sorry to say it was not only Nestle, but some other company in the United States. And it's not exactly, well, I don't want to, you know, to be a, comment est-ce qu'on dit, un délateur. I don't want to, no. But it's very strange because in the States, it's only Nestle which is boycotted. They would not boycott their own companies, but they would boycott Nestle. The end of it was that they have to withdraw this type of milk from the commerce, despite the fact that it has been authorized by the French Ministry of Health. So it proves only that when we take the example of a man like Nader, the American journalist, even if we face those terrible multinational company, I think we have a certain chance to be have some success. So I think it's quite true, and I think the last vote at the UNO, maybe you have watched that, but it's very interesting. At the last vote at the WHO, there has been a sort of rule that there will be no such mercantile traffic in the third world, and even in France, we have now an agreement with the milk factories that no milk, powdered milk, will be distributed freely in hospitals as publicity, because we want to promote breastfeeding. And the only country which didn't vote, there were 102 votes, the only country which votes against that was the United States. And maybe you know that it was discovered, and it was free, it was written in the papers, that a personal counselor of President Reagan has had $25,000 for the affair. I'm not inventing that, it's perfectly true. And even though the people who run the Nestlé company in Switzerland do not, they are not very much worried about that, because Nescafé is more important than any milk industry. So that's a reaction. Maybe you are shocked by my free of expression. After all, I am in Canada, in the States, and I think you are used to that. I don't say that to make a small talk. I think it's very important for us to be able to do that. And I would like finally, maybe, because I show you the herbicides, do you know how the abuse of herbicides was stopped? There was a confidential report at the NIH during the war on the danger of herbicide being teratogenic, a very dangerous product, and it was stolen by a medical student. And this medical student went to Mr. Woodside, a very well-known journalist who published a book and who published articles in the New Yorker. That, plus the AAAA, Association for Advancement of Sciences, plus some doctors like myself, I think we were able to persuade, to force the Dow Chemical Company to withdraw their product, because it was dangerous not only for the Vietnamese but even for the Americans. So I think that this new trend, which permits us not to face what I say, comment est-ce qu'on peut dire, l'escroquerie. Well, not burglary, but the equivalent of burglary, of it. Abuse of confidence all over the world, I think might be counteracted. But in fact, I think it's difficult, because on the long run, they always find a way to restore their power, etc. But it is true that the affair of Nestlé company was a scandal. In the same time, America boycotts Nestlé, in the same time, they were the only one to counteract this vote in the UNO. It's difficult to understand, but I don't think morality plays a role in politics. As long as you know that the Khmer Rouge, which probably are the Nazi of the Southeast Asia, because they killed 3 million people out of 8, have their seat at the UNO in New York. Well, I don't know what to say. Maybe I should say, I'm sorry, because I think we should make some fun. At the time you Canadians are in trouble, I always end up my talks in saying, "Vive the British Columbia Libre."
Dr. Sidney Siegel, Professor of Pediatrics, will thank our speaker. Dr. Cairns, Mr. Justice, and Mrs. Nemetz, members of the Vancouver Institute and friends, in some parts of some cities you see huge billboards saying continuous performances. My friend, Professor Minkowski, has been providing not the kind of continuous performances that we see on those billboards, but for the last several days, having come from guard duty in his hospital to prevent incendiary fires over the last few days, landed in Halifax, was put in front of a podium, spent a whole day and evening lecturing, got on an airplane, and for the last 4 or 5 days here in Vancouver has interrupted a number of his presentations only to provide press interviews and other kinds of impositions that we have placed on him. He was delivering lectures on science, medical care, preventive medicine, methods of motivating people to take responsibility for their own health care, motivating government, and he has given us some insight into his humanitarian motivation that he's always had for himself. I think that as an old friend and colleague who has preceded me only very short interval in training to carry out scientific and medical research, he spent much of his life making this kind of activity come alive in a field that nobody had paid much attention to, the field of reproductive medicine, the field of producing babies that are healthy enough to be happy and to become happy parents. Now he has come to show us how another aspect of health care, health maintenance, can be made to come alive. I think that he's shown us one of the basic problems in the developing countries, and that is the fact that in so many of them, what they really need is field medicine, basically from indigenous sources, but they don't want to be treated as developing countries, and so they insist upon having all of the open heart surgery and the other kinds of high technology that cannot be used. I think he has aptly pointed to some of our needs in the developing communities in our own country, amongst the native people and others. Of course, Alex has always been ahead of his time. He started out ahead of his time. If I can divulge the fact that he was born prematurely. But he caught up. He caught up very quickly with his development. And we can say that he has developed not only himself in an accelerated fashion, but I think he has helped to develop a number of other people in their concepts. I think that he has moved himself and perhaps many others from the hard type of medicine and clinical science into a much more humanistic concern for people. Not only to help people themselves, as he has done in so many ways, but to help people to help other people. That is, to help non-medical people to provide what they can with services that the doctors themselves are not competent to do. He has shown a lot of courage, I think, at least in the beginning when he faced the Mackie, when he worked with the Mackie, facing the Gestapo and all the dangers that went with that. He's shown a lot of courage throughout the rest of his scientific career in facing all kinds of criticism from people who were ready to criticize him rather than what he was doing. And all this time working for, as he said, children, which means also babies, their mothers, and their families. I think that as a sentimentalist, which he confesses to, he has shown a great deal of accompanying courage, strong motivation, which cannot help but motivate a great many others who work him just as hard as we have. Alex, thank you so much for coming across half the world to do this for us.
Next week, Professor French Tickner of this university will speak on the opera, an exotic and irrational entertainment. Good evening.